We're going to go back just for a second here and kind of catch up on what has transpired, at least at from the beginning of the conflict with England, that results in our independence when all is said and done. We'll go back to April the 19th, 1775, which you ought to have memorized as a date that stands and looms in American history. And April the 19th, anybody know what that was? There you go. April the 19th was the shots heard around the world. Lexington and Concord, the first actual battle of the battle for independence in America. Now, again, it actually is not the Revolutionary War per se. It's hard to distinguish when the Revolutionary War began, in the sense that it really wasn't declared, and it really wasn't something that the colonists nor the British wanted to fight. It was just an inevitable thing because of the divergent views of government as well as religious freedom that brought the thing to a beginning. The Revolutionary War certainly does not end until about 1783. It ends with the Treaty of Paris. So you're looking at a long process, a long fight. And part of that, of course, because warfare is fought much slower in these days and times, you'll rarely anymore, ever, are going to see a war last more than 2 or 3 weeks. It just isn't going to happen. This is not the day anymore of long, drawn-out campaigns. And when you see something taking longer than that, you know it's a situation where somebody has a vested interest in it, and there's a green dollar in it. Have you noticed all the sports playoffs have been going 7 and 8 games here? People wonder why that is. Money, yeah, that's it, exactly. And you say, are you accusing people of throwing games? I wouldn't do a thing like that. But somebody's got to pay for those gold rings and fancy diamond rings and Mercedes and all that good stuff. I just thought that was intriguing. And when you see a war like Vietnam, lingering on years and years and years and years, you can be assured of one thing, that is that nobody wants to win. That's called a conflict. It's not really called a war. This country possessed the power to take Vietnam out. We could have obliterated North Vietnam in less than 48 hours at any point through the war. And we chose not to do that. We did not want to win that war, and so we lost it. We basically lost that war. And you watch what we went over there to Hussein's dealy there, and we didn't win that war either, but we did put a pretty good show of strength. In just a matter of a few days, we showed the world what we could. Listen, we could have taken that thing out in just a few days without any problem, and we chose not to do that. Warfare and the state of warfare today, war is not going to last very long. That's why when the Lord comes back to the Valley of Megiddo over there at the end of the tribulation period, that battle is going to last approximately 30, 40 seconds and it'll be over with. All the nations of the world will be gathered together, and the Lord, the Bible said, will open his mouth, and out of his mouth goes a sharp two-edged sword. And the Bible tells us in the Old Testament that the flesh consumes away and their eye sockets hollow out. He just opens his mouth and they just die. And end of battle. But we're in that phase now. Our technology makes it so that a long, drawn-out war is just not going to happen. And you take World War II and wars like that that lasted for years and years and years with hundreds and hundreds of thousands killed, you can do the same thing now in a matter of minutes. When we bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima, we brought ourselves into a new age, and war will never be fought the same again. So the length of the battle, the Revolutionary War, part of it was because things are at a much slower pace. You can't get on airplanes and fly 200 miles overnight, land, set up a war. You have to march 2-3 weeks and get in position, and of course things take longer. So the Revolutionary War takes a great period of time. Secondly, and probably more importantly, it took a great period of time because nobody really understood exactly all the ins and outs of are we at war or are we not at war? Are we fighting or are we not? There are some definite advantages that the colonists possess and some disadvantages that they possess that we'll look at. But nonetheless, April the 19th is a date that you ought to remember as the shots heard around the world. That's the first blow against freedom, and the patriots recoil and take up arms and go to fight. Last year, April the 19th, or I guess it was a year ago, April the 19th, something else happened you're probably not aware of, which was a blow against liberty, and nobody said a word. That was the burning of the compound at Waco, Texas. And your liberty went out the window there. Nobody said a word. Nobody fired a shot in protest. But Lexington, Concord, under the British troops, under the command of General Gage, were sent to Lexington and then to Concord. They knew that the Minutemen, who had been trained there, had stored supplies, as well as two of their most vocal spokespersons lived in that area, John Hancock and Samuel Adams. Those two fellows were thorns in the flesh of the crown. And they had decided that God had given them a land, and that land was destined to be a land of freedom. And so they were basically preaching that everywhere they went. Gage took his troops to Lexington and Concord with the express purpose of arresting those two individuals and seizing the ammunition and things. As far as his objectives were concerned, he lost because he didn't arrest either one of them and he didn't get any of the supplies. They got the supplies out for the most part, and it was a failure. Not only there, but it was a failure in the statistics as far as the casualties. There were 93 patriots that were killed. In the battle that ensued from Lexington to Concord and then back again, but in that same battle there are 273 British casualties. And the British casualties largely because the British did not know how to fight the way the Americans knew how to fight. The Americans had learned from fighting the Indians and during the French and Indian War that you don't fight in the open. You don't stand out on a battlefield and shoot or volley back and forth. You hide in the bushes, and when they come by, you ambush them. And all the way from Concord back to Lexington, the British troops were almost under constant fire from the woods. And they just continually were taking casualties because these patriots were hiding back there behind trees and everything else. And so the war began really on an up note for the Americans. Even though 93 patriots had died, 273 British, they felt like they had taught the British a lesson. But 273 was nothing. Really, in the numbers, the vast numbers of ranks that the British held and that we're going to bring into this country. The British, May the 10th, or the English, excuse me, the Patriots, I'm sorry, May the 10th, 1775. This is just the next month. Clark and Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen and these guys shoot up there. Ethan Allen, I told you before, and Benedict Arnold were kind of in a race to see who could get there first. Benedict Arnold was a great general, and he had problems believing that anybody was going to beat him to the punch, so he went racing there, and they kind of arrived about the same time. So Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain boys, who really were probably the beginnings of what we'd call guerrilla warfare, and Ethan Allen met up with Benedict Arnold, and they went into Fort Ticonderoga, which was one of the most heavily armed forts that the British had. And we talked again, and the whole underlying idea behind what we're teaching is to show you God's involvement. Now, I want you to know, I am firmly convinced that God was working behind the scenes in the establishment of the nation of America. You'll never convince me otherwise. I am assured from what I have seen and read that God was in position manipulating the events that brought about liberty in this country. And you'll not convince me otherwise. And so I think we're seeing today the devil taking all that away. I mean, he's taking all of that away. He's going to remove, I believe, the greatest nation as far as missions and as far as religious liberty is probably going to become one of the worst in the next few years as far as persecution of God's people. And if we've enjoyed religious liberty, get ready, because I think we're going to enjoy the persecution as well that comes with that. But they got to the fort, and Fort Ticonderoga, as I said, in upstate New York there, one of the most heavily defended British forts at that time. And strangely enough, that the night that they arrived, they had left the gates of that fort wide open. They didn't bother to close the gates. And as they rushed into the fort, there was one sentry on duty, and that sentry aimed his musket and pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off. Now, you can explain that as coincidence all you want, But they rushed into the fort. They banged on the door of the commanding officer, and when he came to the door, Ethan Allen demanded that he surrender the fort, and he said, on whose authority? And he said, on the authority of Jehovah God and the Continental Congress. And they took the fort without firing a shot. And so things, again, appear to be going pretty well for the colonists. And maybe that was the Lord's way of encouraging them in this project. I'm not sure, but I know that the things began well. And then you go on to June. We've gone April, May, and June. You get up into June of 1775, and Gage is joined in Boston by General Howe, General Clinton, and General Burgoyne. They begin to amass their individuals, their troops together. And the Battle of Bunker Hill takes place. Now, you've probably heard of the Battle of Bunker Hill, and it's one of the early indications of how the press is going to enact in the American way of life. The Battle of Bunker Hill was never fought on Bunker Hill. Bunker Hill was next to where the battle was fought. The Battle of Bunker Hill was actually fought on Breed's Hill. But the news media reported it as Bunker Hill, and Bunker Hill it is to this day. And yet if you go there to visit, you'll see Bunker Hill over here, and then you'll see where the battle took place over here on Breed's Hill. So always depend on the news media to get it at least one mountain away from the truth. And that's been that way all the way through. But these generals amassed their individuals, and they began to attack what few colonists there are, the Minutemen, the Continental Army, that's there on top of Breed's Hill. That's where the phrase you've heard so often comes from, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. That came from the Battle of Bunker Hill, Battle of Breed's Hill. And the reason for that is the colonists didn't have hardly any ammunition. They were very, very poorly armed and very little ammunition to sustain them. And so as the British forces began to come up the hill, it was decided if we wait, the longer we wait, the more we're likely to kill. And so that battle actually took three charges before the British got any. I mean, they came up the first time, and there was no resistance, and they got a little foolhardy, thought that the colonists were just going to collapse. And when they got about 8 to 10 feet away from the ramifications, they opened fire and just wiped them out. And they got back down to the bottom of the hill, and they reorganized their troops, and the word went through the colonial lines that we're way low on ammunition. This time, let them get closer. So they started up the hill again, and when the British got to where all the other dead British soldiers lay, there was no sound heard, and they thought, well, they're out of ammunition. This time, we've got them. Well, this time, when they got 3 or 4 feet away, they opened up and wiped them out again. And on the third charge up the hill, the colonists had to retreat. They didn't have any ammunition left. But they retreated with very, very small casualties. There was 100 Americans that lost their lives at Bunker Hill, and there was over 1,000 British casualties. So again, now, you've got to realize the situation. That'd be like you and I with a couple of pistols going against the United States Marine Corps. That's the disparity or the disagreement between the size and the effectiveness of the forces. These guys are not trained soldiers. These guys are silversmiths and blacksmiths. These guys are carpenters and preachers. And they're out there with hunting rifles or hunting guns and no training whatsoever. And they come down off that hill now. They've taken Ticonderoga. They've hurt the British at, hurt the British, I'm going to look at my notes here, at Lexington and Concord, I'm confused this morning, and now they've hurt them at Bunker Hill. And the British have been humiliated three times. Now, what begins to happen when you've seen some victories, the same thing's true in your spiritual life, when you get two or three victories under your belt, what happens? You get a little arrogant. And the colonists begin to think, boy, this is going to be an easy fight, it's going to be over very quickly, and the British are just going to give up and retreat, and it didn't happen. The British come back in force. What happened is after June, the battle at Bunker Hill, in less than a couple of months, the British just got out. They just left. They got on the boats and they headed out to Nova Scotia. The colonists thought, man, we've won. What they were doing was going back to reamass their forces and to meet up with the reinforcements. And when they come back, it's a little different story. Now, the colonists all through here are making attempts to appease the crown. It's not their intent that they should break away from England. You have to realize where these colonists are. 90% of the provisions that the colonies have come from England. I mean, there's not a lot because of all the enactments and things. I've mentioned to you before, they weren't allowed to produce their own iron. They weren't allowed to even make hats. There was the Hat Act. And Britain forbade the colonies to even manufacture hats because of the way it would hurt the economic system of England, because they couldn't sell hats then. They'd have to compete with the colonists. So very little trade has been going on in the colonies other than smuggling and cheating to get things through. And now they're not real quick to throw all that away. And you wouldn't be either. The greatest thing probably could happen in America is if 90% of the economy in this country just collapsed. If you couldn't go to the grocery store, Miss Bailey and Brother Bill just home from Greece, and she was asking last night, where can I go? You know, how late can I find a store open? All night. No problem. It's not a problem at all to find a store open all night anymore. Whatever you need, you can find all-night pharmacies, you can find all-night grocery stores, you can find all-night Kmarts, if you know, whatever you need, you can find open 24 hours a day. Well, that wasn't the way in the colonies. I mean, you had to wait on the ship to arrive from England, and then you had to find the provisions you want and pay a large price and a high tax on it. And even so, to cut that off meant there was none coming. And so the colonists are not real quick to shoot themselves, so to speak, in the foot. And at the same time, they want freedom, but they are loyal to the crown. You have to realize that a lot of these people were born in England. They're English citizens. And to stand against your own sovereign nation is a great task indeed. And so for these people, there's a lot of mixed emotions. I mean, the flag that flies over their enemy now is the flag they've waved for years and years and years. And their patriotism now is with something else that's never been before, and so it's difficult. They try to appease the crown. They try to reach out to the king over there and say, wait a minute, we'd like to let bygones be bygones. We'd like to have peace here. But there were certain principles and certain lines that had been drawn that could not be undone. In July of 1775, this is 1 year before your Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress enacted and sent to England what was called the Olive Branch Petition. Now, obviously, with a name like that, you just got to guess what it was all about. They're trying to say, hey, let's stop this before it gets out of hand. Let's not let this thing continue until a lot of people get hurt. And that was followed up by another bill called the Declaration of the Causes and the Necessity of Taking Up Arms. And what they did in that bill, not only again was to extend the olive branch for peace, but also was to try to explain to the King of England and the British Parliament why they felt compelled to take up arms. What had been done to them? What had happened to them? And of course, you realize their biggest complaints were the fact that they had taxation without representation. Okay, and I realize you and I face great taxation today, and of course we're always represented, aren't we? And, you know, I'll be honest with you, the British Crown never accepted that. The British Crown always stated that Americans were represented in Parliament. And so that argument was never, we accept it because we won the war, you know, kind of became the big deal because we won the war, so obviously we were right. We were taxed without being represented. But the British Crown always maintained that the English colonists were represented in the colonies by the Parliament. They never accepted that. So I'm sure if you said today you're being taxed without representation, it probably wouldn't be accepted as a valid complaint. However, we'll just leave it at that. That was in July. In August, George III responds. And really, everything is in his hands up to this point. He holds the aces, and it's all up to him how this thing goes. He responds with what's called the Proclamation of Rebellion. I'll give you an idea how he feels. Under the Proclamation of Rebellion, he accuses the colonies of rebelling against his sovereignty, rebelling against their own nation, and labels them actually nothing but a bunch of rebels. In December of 1775, he enacts what's called the Prohibitory Act. And the Prohibitory Act are what we would call economic sanctions. See, we've got much better terminology in this day and time, but that's what economic sanctions are all about. Under the Prohibitory Act, England basically cut off trade with the colonies in an attempt to starve them out. Also, in these two bills, King George hired Hessian troops. And for the first time, foreign troops were brought to America to be used to control the population of this country. And those Hessians were basically German soldiers. The Germans have always loved war and probably always will love war. And I think Dr. Ruckman said the saying is that the Germans have is, in case of rain, the war will be held in the auditorium. He told about the fellow, they put him in a wood shop, you know, to try and teach him a new trade after the war, and put him in there with wood, and he made a machine gun. And, you know, there's just something about the German mentality, a warring people. And so George hires Hessian troops, brings them to America with the sole intent of using these foreign troops to control the population of America. Now that's important for you to remember. It's important as we go through here for you to see what sparked this revolution, because you're going to be amazed when we get into the Constitution. Every one of the 10 Bill of Rights has been attacked within the last 3 years in this country. Every one of them. And these people here are fighting, and I passed out constitutions this morning, which I guess basically could be construed as treason in this day and time. But you have them nonetheless, okay? They are American constitutions, and there they are. But he begins to enact this legislation, and war basically is the outcome of that. War breaks out more in earnest. January of 1776, Thomas Paine publishes his book called Common Sense. And Thomas Paine does not have a lot of respect in our circles, because later in life, Thomas Paine went to France, got mixed up in the French Revolution, and became basically, for all practical points and purposes, a humanist, an atheistic humanist, and denounced his any belief in Christ and really ridiculed Christianity. But at this point, Thomas Paine is he's a patriot. And Thomas Paine's book on common sense basically was a treatise that encouraged the American people that, hey, it just makes sense to fight against people that are attacking you. It just makes sense to defend yourself. It just makes sense to defend your homeland, to defend your houses and your property, to defend your family. And that's what Thomas Paine wrote about. And that one document, along with preachers that are preaching in their pulpits at this time, literally incite people to go against the British Crown. In March of 1776 now, which is just the spring of 1776, there's been a deadlock in Boston. I told you before, the British had lost a great number of men trying to take Bunker Hill. They had secured a position in Boston of control, and Washington had been appointed as commander now of the Continental Army. He's gone in to take control of the army. The first order that Washington ever gave to his troops was no profanity in the rank, and you got to go to church. That sounds like a commanding general, doesn't it? First order he gives to his army, no profanity in the ranks, and you got to go to church. Washington begins to encounter one of the great difficulties of the war, and that was a lack of unity. Remember, these are independent colonies. And as independent colonies, they don't really owe the other colonies anything. They're there fighting, they're in the same war, but when Virginia sends its rifle squadron, and Pennsylvania sends its troops, and New York sends troops, they have their own commanders. And what Washington encounters when he goes and assumes command of this Continental Army is he finds a group of leaders that are basically going to show favoritism to their own troops. I mean, obviously, if you're the commander of the Virginia Brigade and the Pennsylvania boys get out of hand, you're going to take the Pennsylvania boys and read them the Riot Act. But if your own boys do that, you've got a problem. If you're involved in a battle where you know somebody's going to die and you're commanding the Pennsylvania boys, you're going to be real reluctant to send the New York boys, or send your Pennsylvania boys when you can send the New York boys. So the first thing Washington does is he shakes up that chain of command. He takes a lot of those men and demotes them, and he switches them around. And Washington understood that if you're going to be a good commander in war, you've got to be willing to watch people die. We talk a lot about leadership and leadership. A good leader realizes that people die in wartime. And you take Patton and these guys, and they're great generals now, and we look at them. But I tell you what, you go back to the time of war, and you'll find those men realize, man, Patton will kill you just as soon as look at you. He'll throw you in there. You look at the fellows that died at Anzio Beach and Monte Cassino, died on the beaches at Normandy. And there were men in control of those men that put them on those beaches, knowing they'd get wiped out, knowing they'd die. And yet, you want to be a good leader, you realize that's the cost of war. Washington knew that. Washington knew that if we're going to win this war, people are going to die, and they're going to have to die to win the war, but they were committed to winning the war. So Washington shakes up his troops. Now he faces Boston. Boston's been held almost a year by the British. The citizenry of Boston have been basically almost starved to death. They've been abused by the British troops, and it's still difficult for Washington to figure a way to defeat them. He has a fellow who's a little bit crazy, one of his commanders, and this commander comes to him and reminds him that Fort Ticonderoga had been captured by the colonists and is one of the most heavily fortified British installations they had. And so they go to Fort Ticonderoga and take the cannons and put the cannons on sleds. It's wintertime. And they bring those cannons through the mud and the snow down to Boston and set those things up on a hill and begin. I mean, they've got an ideal spot for bombardment. Anyway, suffice it to say that in the end, the British troops are leaving. They pack up and leave, and that's where they're headed out. And they're not going away, however, forever, but they are forced to leave and abandon Boston. Another colonial victory. It appears as though the colonists are doing very well. However, what they have in essence done is gone up to Nova Scotia to meet with reinforcements that are headed from England. That was in March. In June and July of 1776, your Continental Congress met for the first time and first of all issued an intent to proclaim liberty or to declare independence, and that was followed by the Declaration of Independence, which was in July the 4th, 1776. You probably won't have any trouble remembering that one. Hopefully, anyway, that has become really the birthday, or what we consider the birthday, of our country. Now, the two documents you want to learn to distinguish. Those two documents are the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I passed out several constitutions this morning. The Constitution is not placed in operation until the end of the Revolutionary War. The Constitution of America is basically the document that is put in place after our nation forms. It is the document that will govern our nation. It is the document that all of our leaders have sworn to uphold. Some of them have lied, but they have sworn to uphold that document. But it is the Declaration of Independence that basically makes the break between the colonies and the British government. Now, I read that to you several weeks ago. And I read the Declaration to you in its entirety. And some of the things that are in there, in other words, the Declaration was given as a response to the people of the world. You get into this situation when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands. What they were doing in the Declaration of Independence is explaining to the world why we're doing this. Why we're fighting our own country. And in there they list the offenses of King George. They state what he's been guilty of and what he's done. One of them is taxation without representation. One of the others was the fact that he had brought foreign troops to American soil to fight against his own people. And what is interesting, if you go back through there and go down through there, probably well over three quarters of them could be laid in Washington today. There are foreign troops in America right now being trained to control Americans. And I showed Dr. Ruckman the other night the crime bill that is before the Senate right now, and I think it's Section 508, which states within 6 months of the passage of that bill, the Attorney General must seek to employ the Royal Hong Kong Police Department as federal police officers in the United States of America. That's in the law. And you say, why is that? That's foreign troops on American soil. Those are people who have no tie to your Constitution. Those are people who don't have any concern at all for a Bill of Rights. And that's the Hessians coming again. That's King George bringing the Hessians back. But the Declaration of Independence is signed. In that, there's a statement made that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And you have to realize what the implication of that is. Those individuals believe that in America, people who lived here were to be granted those inalienable rights that were given to them by whom? By God. And as you and divorce it from the existence of God, you are going to destroy those rights. And this, I mean, they come back, they say, well, you know, you're the religious right. You know, you're the extreme right. And we are. We're right. Problem with that? Nothing to be ashamed of about being right. But there has been an attempt in the last 20 to 30 years to divorce from America its foundations in biblical Christianity. And if you divorce America or the American way of life from its foundations in biblical Christianity, you will destroy this nation, and that's what you've got right now. That's where you are. The first statement for liberty made in the Declaration of Independence said they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Therefore, those rights supersede the Constitution, do they not? The Constitution does not give you rights. You had those rights before the Constitution was ever written. You had those rights before the Declaration was signed. Those rights came to you from God Himself. And so when somebody begins to attack God, they're attacking your inalienable rights. And when those inalienable rights are gone, then you're going to have a government that grants to you rights. And that's where you are now. You read through the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, and that's the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Things change a little later. But the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, as we get there and study them, you're going to see that they didn't grant anybody any rights. In other words, because the amendment was signed that said that you'll have the right to keep and bear arms, that didn't mean that the government gave you the right to own a gun. You already had that right. The Bill of Rights was there to define those inalienable rights. That's why it says Congress shall make no law establishing a religion. You already had the right to freedom of worship in this country. And the Bill of Rights said you can't, government can't take that right away from you. Government can't take the right of freedom of assembly away from you. Government can't take the right of freedom of speech away from you. Government can't take the right of freedom of keeping and bearing arms away from you. Why? You have that as an inalienable right. That didn't come with the Constitution. That came long before and supersedes the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence spelled out the grievances that the colonies had against King George. It'd be interesting reading for you. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'll give you an idea of how it's come here. I've had three people hand me this article this morning, and kind of interesting here. Says a Georgia woman who slapped her unruly 9-year-old son in public is now facing felony charge of cruelty to children, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported Saturday. Police handcuffed the mother, Lynn Kivy, took mug shots, and then a magistrate remanded her to the local county jail where she remained until her husband cashed in his 401k retirement account to pay a $22,050 bond and hire a lawyer. The newspaper said the incident happened last month in Woodstock, Georgia, a small town located 20 miles north of Atlanta where the family recently moved from Illinois. Kivy told the newspaper her son Chuck was incorrigible while shopping at the local Winn-Dixie supermarket and had started picking on his 12-year-old sister Sarah. I told him, you don't speak to anybody that way. He shot back, I'm not talking to you. At that point, she slapped the youngster across the face. But as the mother and her two children left the store to get into the car, a police officer approached. He said an employee in the Winn-Dixie called and said, I slapped my kid. I said, yeah, I did. He was being rotten. Under Georgia law, parents are allowed to employ reasonable forms of discipline in raising their children so long as any resulting injury is minimal. You're allowed to employ? Somebody's trying to give you rights. And when the state gives you rights, you can count on it, they're going to take them away. Now that's where it's come to. I'm going to tell you what, that happened in 1776. They'd have lynched a Winn-Dixie employee, and they'd have had to hire a new law enforcement officer because he'd have quit. Welcome to America. Now, does it sound to you like we've got more freedom now than we had 100 years ago? Land of the free, home of the brave? I don't think so. Going into this thing, one of the greatest forces that existed in gaining momentum for a revolution was the clergy. And let me digress just for a minute. I want to read this to you. I copied this morning. The men who influenced the framers of our Constitution, the writers of the Declaration of Independence, are the people, you know, we've got a federal judiciary set up today. It's called the Supreme Court of the United States. It is the job of the Supreme Court of the United States to determine the constitutionality of law. That law is enacted by the legislative branches of Congress and the Senate. They place things as law. The executive branch signs them and sanctions them. And then the Supreme Court decides the constitutionality. Now, I realize that's the way our country's set up, and I do not have a great number of qualms with it, other than the fact that you need to know that that was not a unanimous decision by the framers of our Constitution. That's not exactly what they wanted. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson was dreadfully opposed to the federal judiciary. Thomas Jefferson was antagonistic of placing the Supreme Court in the land as anything you've ever heard of. I've got his writings in my office. And Jefferson said that the federal judiciary will prove to be the undoing of the American way of life. He said that no group of individuals had a right to determine the constitutionality, that was reserved for the people themselves. And Jefferson was not alone. There were others that were involved in that. And they disagreed strongly with that. But the judiciary was established. And the judiciary's job is to interpret the constitutionality of law. Now, what's happened up to about 20 years ago was they determined what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. No longer is that what they determined. What they determine now is what will meet the objective or the ends that they have in mind, and what will bring about basically a one-world government, and that's the way they're headed. That's why if you slap a 9-year-old child, you have to pay a $22,050 bond, but if you go out and cut a woman's head off and stab to death another man, you're not even arrested. The new crime bill, somebody else showed me an article this morning now, the new crime bill is calling for racial quotas in punishing crime. I tell you what that means. That means since the white race is the largest race in America, you have to execute more white people than you do people of other colors, no matter how the crime rate goes. Now, you look at me kind of funny, folks. Don't you read your newspapers? You really don't, do you? You read the funny paper, and then you listen to Dan Rather, and you're convinced it's all hunky-dory in America. That's in the paper either this morning or yesterday. I just looked at the article this morning. And that's supposedly also in this crime bill. Racial quotas. That means if you execute a Mexican or a black, you have to turn around and execute 4 or 5 white men because you have to maintain racial quotas. Now, I'm going to tell you why you can't control crime. We don't need gun control. We need Congress control. But the men who influenced the framers of our Constitution, it's important that you read them. I began by reading the writings of John Locke. John Locke and Blackstone were two of the most often cited individuals by the framers of the Constitution. By the way, I think we showed you the film, and in the film it was determined, a study was done as to who Franklin and Jefferson and Washington and Adams, who they quoted. And all of the quotes that they made that were recorded were compiled. And a study was done to see who they quoted the most. And I believe it was Blackstone that they quoted as an individual more than anybody else. They quoted John Locke, and they quoted Montesquieu, which is another, he's a student of Blackstone. And they quoted those individuals more than any other individuals that they quoted. But seven times more frequently, they quoted the Bible. Seven times more than they quoted anybody else, their quotes consist of biblical passages. And to divorce again, to divorce our nation from its biblical foundation and heritage, is to execute our nation. But here's what Blackstone said. Blackstone said that concerning the laws of nature, the laws of inalienable rights given by their creator, this will of his maker is called the law of nature. This will of his maker. So you start teaching evolution and you don't have a maker. If you don't have a maker, then you don't have any inalienable rights. If you don't have any inalienable rights, the only way to get rights is with government. That's exactly the socialistic system. That's a communistic system. And America has become a socialistic system. And the first step is you remove God. The will of his maker is called the law of nature. For as God, when he created matter and endued it with a principle of mobility, established certain rules for the perpetual direction of that motion, so when he created man and endued him with a free will to conduct himself in all parts of life, he laid down certain immutable laws of human nature, whereby that free will is in some degree regulated and restrained, and gave him also the faculty of reason to discover the purport of those laws. What's he saying? He's saying that God placed within man an ability to govern himself. So when the framers of your Constitution said that government only exists by the consent of the people, consent of the governed, that's what they're saying. What they're saying is a man, a woman, they have a perfect ability to govern themselves, or they ought to. And the idea was, I don't remember who used the illustration, but it was a good illustration. You go out to the Wild West back in the 1800s, and here's the way government works. Back in the Wild West, you've got 100 cattle ranches out there. These guys all got cattle. And so you've got the opportunity to sit out on your porch every day with a loaded shotgun and protect your cattle out there from horse thieves. But you've got 100 guys sitting out on their porch protecting their cattle. So what they do, those 100 men get together and say, let's hire a sheriff. And now those 100 men can go out and do other things, and the sheriff protects their cattle. That doesn't mean the sheriff has the authority. And that's the way government's established. Individuals with the right to govern themselves give that authority to another agency so they, in turn, can occupy themselves with other things. And that's where creation of the government, the creation of government comes about. Government was established to maintain an army and regulate foreign commerce. That's what it was established for. Why? Because I don't have time to go negotiate a peace treaty with France so I can sell the hats that I make in France. So I'll let the government do that. I don't have time to keep my guns loaded and watch out here on the coast to see if a foreign enemy's coming to invade. I've got other things I have to do, so I'll give that authority to government. Some of you follow this, maybe a brand new economics or government lesson for you. That's how governments come into being. And John Locke and Blackstone all stated that individual human government existed long before collective government did. And that collective government could not have existed if individual government had not existed. And we basically relinquished the government, those areas that we chose not to be occupied in, and established government. Now, how did we get our freedom? We got our freedom from God. That's what they maintained. It's what every one of them maintains. And so you begin to teach man that he doesn't have a creator and that there is no God. You talk about civil rights. The government went after your civil rights about 100 years ago. And you're just now seeing the fulfillment of that. When you're hauled into a court, what are you going to use to say, I have rights? 100% of the cases in court today where people are pleading rights all involve rights granted by the government. I have rights that supersede government. I don't need government to tell me what I can and can't do. I have those rights. Now, with rights comes responsibilities. I may have to die. And what's happened is you took away God, you took away mankind's creator, made him a descendant of an ape, and you took away his desire to die for anything. You gave him a cushy lifestyle. And now he can be controlled and manipulated. And that's exactly where you live today. He said this, considering the creator only a being of infinite power, he was unquestionably to have prescribed whatever laws he pleased to his creature man, however unjust or severe. You've heard me say that 100 times. God makes the rules. You can sit back and say they're unfair, they're fair, I don't like. It doesn't matter what you think. People say, well, I don't like, you know, God made me this way. Too bad. God is the one that has the power. He says, but as he is also a being of infinite wisdom, he has laid down only such laws as were founded in those relations of justice that existed in the nature of things antecedent to any positive precept. I know this is probably difficult to follow. But he's saying God's merciful. God laid down laws that will protect the independence of man, the freedom of man. That's what God's law. You look at the laws of the Old Testament. I've told you before, if you would abide by those laws, if you had a nation, and I'm not putting everybody back under the law, I'm not a legalist, but if you and I lived in a country where those laws were observed to the letter, you would live in a country that would be disease-free, debt-free, and crime-free. I mean, God's unfair laws, God's unjust laws, God laid those laws down to protect his individuals and to give you that liberty. He says here, these are the eternal, immutable laws of good and evil. Therefore, it is not the government's job to determine good and evil. Those are immutable laws of God himself. Therefore, if I'm going to find out whether a fellow's good or bad, what am I going to do? I've got to go to the Bible. So you get rid of the Bible. You get rid of God. You get rid of God as a creator. You lose those inalienable rights. You get rid now of good and evil. And what have you got? You got a runaway crime rate nobody can take care of. America is dead. The America of Jefferson, Washington, Adams is gone. And this new America, it's the devil's America. That's what you've got. These are the eternal immutable laws of good and evil to which the Creator himself and all his dispensation conforms. God lives under his own law. God does not tell you something is evil for you and I and then live and oblige himself in that evil. He abides by his own laws. And which he has enabled human reason to discover so far as they are necessary for the conduct of human actions. Such, among others, are these principles: that we should live honestly, should hurt nobody, and should render to everyone his due, to which three general precepts Justinian has reduced the whole doctrine of law. What he's saying, the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. He just reduces it. They are these. Number one, we should live honestly. So there's got to be some people of integrity. I believe it was Adams said that our Constitution was framed for a moral people and it will not govern any other kind. So we don't have a moral people. You've got to learn to live honestly, should hurt nobody, and should render to everybody his due. Those are the three principles. Where did they come from? Those are principles God laid down. Those are the principles God laid down. And it is those principles there that have determined and have placed in line the Constitution of America, which came much later. But I wanted to give you an idea. That's what Blackstone said. He's the most often quoted source by the men that wrote the Constitution of America. So when they put in the Constitution that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, what do you think they're talking about? They're talking about what that man just said right there. They've been reading Blackstone. He talks about those inalienable rights and those immutable laws. And the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness never stated that you have a right to do wrong. Because he said God had already placed down the distinctions between right and wrong. That's not what they were saying. The Constitution of America never guaranteed the right of a homosexual to live his ungodly lifestyle. Now, there'll be those that'll argue that with you, but the framers of the Constitution said that God gave you some inalienable rights, but he also put down some immutable laws. And they didn't bother spelling all those out because they knew what they were. They had a Bible to tell them. So it's been done away. Now, great part of the support of the early revolution was given by the clergy. We've got to quit. There was so much hatred toward the clergy, realizing now that in England you had the Anglican Church, the state church system. You didn't have that in America. You had Presbyterians, you had Congregationalists, you had Baptists, you had Catholics, you had Quakers. You had all kinds of groups assembled together and had their own religious worship services. They were not under any federal or any state-controlled support other than in Massachusetts. You were basically free of that. And when England began to fight it out with America, the Anglican bishops, they had to keep their mouth shut. Why? Because their paycheck came from the Anglican Church. See, when you place, you've got priests in this town. You know where they get their money from? Their money from Rome. Now, my question, what do you think they're going to do if they disagree with the Pope? What do you do when you disagree with your employer? Shut your mouth, right? Take the paycheck and go on. And you set up a system like that, you don't have a free clergy. But these other guys, they didn't live under that kind of guys. And they were free to open their mouths and speak their thoughts, and buddy, they did. So much so that the British called them the Black Regiment. That's what they called it because they wore black coats and black shoes and black pants and black hat, and they were called the Black Regiment. Because they had such a hard time controlling them. You've got guys like John Hart. John Hart was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. They say that religion has no place in government. No, government has no place in religion. There's not any law in there. This idea of the separation of church and state, we'll get to that later on, isn't found in any founding document whatsoever. The phrase separation of church and state doesn't occur in the Declaration of Independence. It doesn't occur in the Constitution. There is no statement in the Constitution that says that religion has no place in government. The amendment to the Constitution in the Bill of Rights said Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. You know what they said? Congress has a stay out of religion, not the other. These fellows, John Hart signs the Declaration of Independence. A fellow by the name of George Duffield was a Presbyterian, was a chaplain for the Continental Armies. These preachers got up and they went to war. The video we saw a couple of weeks ago talked about the preachers would, after their services were over on Sunday morning, they'd go out and drill the troops in the churchyard. They'd march and take bayonet practice and then have a meal and come back in for church that night. That's where the Minutemen trained. And most of the commanders, when they went off into battle, were the pastors. These people have been following the pastor spiritually. It was easier to follow him than it was to decide which one of them was more qualified to lead. They followed the preachers into battle. Strange thing. James Caldwell was a Presbyterian preacher. James Caldwell, they came to arrest him and he wasn't there, and it's not clear whether they intentionally did it or not, but most think they did. They shot his wife to death. Killed his wife. He was a preacher, Presbyterian preacher. Caldwell came back that afternoon and went to fight with the British, and he's the one that they ran out of wadding for their muskets. And heavy paper. If you know anything about a black powder, you got to have the wadding in there to tamp all that stuff down. They ran out of paper to wad and put in those muskets. And he ran over to the church that he pastored, where his wife had been shot to death, and brought out those hymnals called Watts hymnals. And tore the pages out, and they made wadding and put them in their muskets and shot and killed the British. And there's a portrait of that in Washington, D.C. from our nation's founding, and it's called Give 'em Watts. That's what it's called. You got pictures of preachers standing there on the doorstep with his musket, and all these guys kneeling around him, and they got a stack of hymn books laying there, and they're just blowing the smithereens, the British. Clergymen. these clergy, they got upset with the clergy. And so you can watch in a free state, you remove God, you're going to eventually restrict the clergy. You can count on it. You turn on Phil Donahue and Oprah Winfrey and all that crowd, I'm going to tell you what you find. You find people that don't talk plain. They don't speak plain. They've got this education ease. And they use words this long that nobody understands, but it impresses people. But you take that and turn a preacher loose that speaks plain English and uses a Bible and quotes principles that they know in their heart are right, and he poses an unbelievable opposition to what they're trying to accomplish. So you got to restrict the clergy. You got to stop them. And the way you do that is you give them tax-exempt status. And then 100 years later, you come and say, we're going to take it away from you if you don't shut your mouth. You realize what happened to us if we lost tax-exempt status, folks? You want to take a guess of what corporate taxes would be on a $2.5, $3 million building and piece of land? Plus back taxes? I'm telling you, you may have to meet in homes before it's all over with. Without preachers. Because they got to put somebody in jail. They stood. Plainness of speech. Now, let me give you some advantages, and I need to close. And I'll give you four. Four advantages that the Patriots had going into this thing. There were four distinct advantages. Now, they've got a number of disadvantages we'll talk about next week, and we'll look at some of the battles because it doesn't go nearly as well. I kind of gave you a false impression this morning. It looks real good going in. But realize this war lasts 6 years, so obviously it didn't keep going as well. But they had some advantages. First of all, they had that patriotic spirit. It's always easier to fight to defend your home. Now, you fellows that went halfway around the world and fought in Vietnam, I'll guarantee you, you thought, what in the world am I doing here protecting somebody else's property when they're not even willing to fight for it themselves? And that's the problem you have every time you go. One good thing about going into Europe during World War II, man, we were paraded everywhere we went. You look at some of those reels of the Americans marching into Paris, I'm going to tell you what, they were heroes. That'll do something for your patriotic spirit. You get over there in Vietnam and them little huts over there in along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, when you fight and lose 25 men to take a group of huts, and then when you're done, some little 10-year-old kid takes a hand grenade and kills 8 of your own men, it's hard to have a patriotic spirit. I heard a couple of fellows say one time, we'd been better off if we'd killed every South Vietnamese and then left the country and let the North have it. What an attitude. But that's what you get. Now, it didn't happen in America. You've got people fighting for their own homes, fighting for their own families. And that's one thing that if the Lord allows this thing to unfold that they've not taken into account yet, a bunch of independent, Bible-believing, Bible-thumping Baptists. And when you come, listen, you fight on their back soil, it'll be a whole lot different. Number two, unpopularity of war in England. Remember, England, I listed the wars they fought with just France alone. They fought like 8 wars with France in the preceding 60 years. They've been at war all, and the English people are tired of fighting wars. They're sick and tired of it. That's to the advantage of the Americans. Number three, experienced military leaders. Now, the guy that wrote these advantages gave you the impression that we had some guys that really knew their stuff. Basically, Washington was experienced in losing. Washington had been whipped several times in the French and Indian War. And you say, what kind of advantage is that? Because when the British attack New York, Washington retreats and retreats and retreats and retreats and retreats and loses hardly any men because he knew how to retreat. And that's funny, but he retreated back across the Delaware and set up camp and came back across the Delaware and wiped them Hessians out and turned the thing right back. You've got to know how to retreat if you're going to know how to win. And the Lord had taught Washington how to retreat. He had some experience in that. And then finally, we had some foreign military assistance. When things got going, guess who came to our aid? Well, England had been fighting against France, And France would like to see nothing more than to see England get whipped, so they begin to send fellows over here like Lafayette, who helped Washington train his troops. You get a fellow by the name of Sade, or Sade, who came from over in Bohemia and was a Prussian general. You get some Germans that are fighting with the Americans. You get some French that are fighting with the Americans. And so we had the advantage of having their expertise on our side. And I think it was Lafayette was one of the, well, was the only, for a number of years, the only foreign soldier ever honored with an American medal. And those men came over here at their own expense. Those men came over here, paid their own way, sold their homes, and came over here to fight against the British. So we're now into the battle, all right? And the war is a couple of years old. It's going to last another 4 or 5 years before it's all said and done.